Your film is now ready to be shown.
Good morning. I'm Justin Hendricks, editor of Tech Policy Press, a nonprofit media venture intended to provoke new ideas, debate, and discussion at the intersection of technology and democracy. On Tuesday, March 25th, Tech Policy Press hosted a webinar discussion to talk shop with others on the tech and democracy beat. We gathered seven colleagues from around the world to explore how tech journalists are grappling with the current political moment in the United States and beyond. In this episode, you'll hear my colleague, Ramsha Jahangir, who is associate editor at Tech Policy Press, in discussion with Reena Chandran from Rest of World, Natalia Antaleva from Coda Story, Anupriya Datta from You're Active, and Anisha Dutta, an award-winning investigative reporter. This discussion delved into the global implications of developments in the U.S. and key lessons from reporting in various political contexts. Questions included, what key narratives are emerging globally from recent shifts in U.S. policy? How is the rise of a tech oligarchy shaping technology coverage outside the U.S.? And what practical lessons can journalists learn from reporting on technology and politics in non-Western contexts? Here's Ramsha.
Thanks so much, Justin. It's been a great conversation so far, and we just hope to make it even better with this very fantastic panel I have here. Just to introduce you, we have Natalia Antaleva, editor-in-chief at Coda Story. And we have Reena Chandran, deputy editor, Rest of World, Anisha Dutta, award-winning journalist with a decade of experience covering national Indian politics, and then finally Anupriya Datta from You're Active, who's been covering European tech laws. So there's quite a bit to get over today, but I hope to do justice in, I think, 40 minutes that we have. I do encourage folks to keep submitting questions, and we will come to those as relevant. So to start this conversation, a lot that we've been seeing in the US, from institutional capture to attacks on the press and media, as well as blatant politicization and weaponization of democratic institutions, is not new, unfortunately, to a lot of us looking at the developments in the US from outside, be it from global majority countries or also Europe, which is also very much in focus right now for various reasons. So we hope to touch on these different aspects in this conversation. I'm going to start with you, Natalia. So Natalia, Coda has been tracking how powerful people in different parts of the world follow similar steps to change politics and what you've called the age of broligarchy. I quite like this term. There are quite many bros out there telling us what to do. So what insights can journalists gain from elsewhere to better understand and report on this new entry of tech oligarchy or the bro oligarchy, however you want to call it, then its impact within the US, but also beyond?
Thank you. And thank you for having me today. It was really interesting to listen to the earlier panel and in part responding to your question, but in part listening to the others, but especially Victoria. I think the key thing to understanding about both our approach and I think to understanding what's happening in the world is that in some ways, it's the same old battle for power and money that we've always had. Like nothing has changed except it's powered by the kind of technology that we've never seen before. And it has the scope and reach that is unprecedented. And I have recently come to really question the usefulness of tech as a beat. I think we are no longer in a position where we can afford to have any conversation, say, about democracy without talking about tech. We can't have any conversations about society. And if you think about it, like we don't have electricity as a beat because electricity affects everything that we do and the way from our, it's changed everything, right? From sleep to the way we work and the way society is structured, and tech is very much the same. And I think siloing out technology as a beat in journalism is probably feeds into what I think is a great part of the great problem with our societies, where everything is siloed out and then easier to not to pay attention to. And this is obviously by no means to undermine in any way the importance of the work that everyone on this call and the previous part of the session does, quite the opposite. But I think the mainstream, there was a lot of talk about the mainstream media, and I think it would be, we would do so much better if technology just became much more part of the core coverage. In a sense, that's what we do at CODA, right? Our work is all about connecting the dots between things that seem to live in silos, things that seem to be isolated. And it was really early on, CODA, we started out as a crowdfunding project back in early 2017. And we started with a proof of concept. We were trying a different approach to both news gathering and basically to news gathering and story generation. And we started with this pilot project that focused very clearly on the LGBTQ and the Russia's war on LGBTQ communities. And at the time, it was well established by the Western media that Russia was just a terrible place to be a gay man or a woman. And no one had explained why. So we were trying to show what is afoot with the Kremlin, like why are they going after it? And it became very quickly apparent the role that the dead tech, that the war against LGBTQ was really the war against liberal values and liberal West, and that it was spreading very fast through various networks that the Kremlin has built to throughout the world. And that technology and tech companies based in Silicon Valley were playing an incredibly important role in all of that, because it also was accompanied by the clampdown on dissent back in Russia. So by connecting the dots between seemingly isolated, there was the LGBTQ issue, and then there was this, all these other things, but in fact, they were very related. And I think again and again through our reporting, we've seen how tech the abuse of technology seems to be a driving force of the authoritarian rise. And it's tied into so much more, into the convenience that it offers, into our unwillingness to give it up, into so many other things. But I think not watching tech and not making tech part of the bigger coverage of everything that's going on is possibly a really big mistake. And I think just very quickly reflecting, and one more thing that Vittoria said that I think is really on point and important is just listen to them. That's all we need to do. I recently heard this term, wishcasting, that apparently like we're all wishcasting, and part of wishcasting is not listening. But all we need to do to know what they're about to do or what they're planning to do is just to listen to them, because they're incredibly transparent in terms of what it is that is being planned.
Rita, turning to you, I think there's also a question already about the global picture of this and selling the global story. So there's a tech story that's now at the forefront, but there's also the global tech story that often gets sidelined in the mainstream. So of course, Rest of World has changed that dynamic and really introduced the global impact in the mainstream. So what's your experience been on that front? And now, given certainly the situation in the US, how can you better tell that story?
I think what's been, as Justin and you pointed out, a lot of this is very familiar to those of us who've been covering other countries. I think what's been most problematic is the spate of legislation that governments have introduced, particularly seizing on the opportunity of COVID. Under the guise of preventing misinformation, there's been a spate of laws from Singapore to India to Indonesia to just about so many countries that introduced laws to supposedly curb misinformation, but have really been used to throttle freedom of speech and expression. And there's been no going back, of course. Singapore, for example, has what's called POFMA, an acronym for their fake news law. And that has been used so often, it's become an adjective. So you can get POFMA'd by the government, and many of the remaining independent media outlets have been POFMA'd. And so has Bloomberg, but just a straightforward report on the real estate market in the country. Bigger outlets can't fight these legislations in court. Even in democracies which have a somewhat independent judiciary, it's really hard. It takes a very long time to fight legislations in court. And the governments are aware of that. We talk about Elon Musk being in government, but in India, Nandan Nilekani, who was the founder of one of the biggest tech companies, Infosys, has been embedded in the government for a long time now. He's the architect behind the digital ID program, Aadhaar, and has been tasked with digitizing government records and systems, supposedly to streamline everything, but also with the end goal of just increased surveillance and job cuts and excluding people from welfare and benefits. And all of this has been accompanied with the complete capitulation of social media platforms, which accede to the government requests on content removal and banning accounts, because these are markets that are big and are still expanding, and they definitely want to be there. India, Brazil, Turkey, South Korea are among the countries with the most number of content removal requests to Google and YouTube. Ironically, X has just sued the Indian government for its what it calls illegal content removal in India just a few days ago. But platforms have just stopped resisting governments. They're completely hand in glove with governments. Sadly, many of these countries don't have a tradition of independent media, but there are a few brave journalists who are trying to set up newsletters and doing independent media. Yeah. Regional media used to do a better job than the mainstream English language media in many of these countries, but journalists there are at even greater risk. They face threats and harassment constantly. You will all remember Gauri Lankesh, who ran a Kannada language newsletter, and she was killed in 2017 for her reporting. Ironically, some of the journalists who were harassed and hounded in India found an outlet in the U.S. media, like Rana Ayub, who earned the name of the most hated journalist in the world. She had a column in the Washington Post, which I don't think she has anymore. We've seen a complete crumbling of institutions. And the way that people use social media is so different as well, with WhatsApp being this massive way to spread information and misinformation in India. But people are using social media platforms any way they can. There are newsletters that are using WhatsApp as a platform, for example, because that's the way that people communicate. But yeah, the fact that there are these legislations and the fact that social media platforms very much want to be on the right side of these governments is on board very well.
I think that's a good segue to Anupriya, Europe, with tech companies taking a very different stance now. And of course, there's this big question, will Europe hold its ground and enforce its tech rule books on social media, competition and AI? So what are some of the narratives that you're witnessing from Brussels, and what are the implications of this recent shift on tech regulation?
Thanks for that. In Brussels, of course, we have passed three very important legislations on tech recently, which includes the Digital Services Act that moderates content and our social media platforms to remove what is seen as illegal content. There's the Digital Markets Act, which is a competition law instrument used against very big platforms that are seen as gatekeepers. And there's the AI Act, which has come into force now very recently as well, that is regulating AI from a risk-based approach. Now, most US big tech companies are under these laws, and during the time these laws were negotiated, was before this administration took power, was that lobbyists and big tech companies were not as vocal and critical about these laws as they are right now. Seems that the Trump administration, from which lobbies for these big tech companies and publicly criticizes these laws, we're at this moment where if the EU enforces these laws, they will be seen as overseas extortion against these US big tech companies. And Trump most recently has threatened to impose tariffs if Brussels does enforce these laws. What we hear from Brussels is a more of a temperature check. The Commission is enforcing these laws, but it's not exactly a national government. It's more of a bureaucratic part of the EU. They will read the law quite literally and enforce through its enforcement actions. And that can mean forcing platforms to comply to these laws, giving them the right to defend, but also then fining them. But it has, in the last few weeks and months, become extremely political in the sense that, for example, Meta's global affairs manager, Joel Kaplan, has come to Brussels and openly criticized these recent EU tech laws. Elon Musk is quite regularly posting against these tech laws, specifically the Digital Services Act. So, of course, now it's up to the Commission on how to respond to this. I think separating tech from these geopolitical tensions is increasingly hard. But I think at the same time, what we see is that the Commission is trying to keep a bit more of an analytical and a legal approach rather than responding more severely, at least within the tech space. Otherwise, if a decision against X or Meta is taken politically, then it'll just go through years of litigation and we'll never actually see the effects of these laws. So indeed, it's an interesting space. I echo the previous panelist who said that it's really hard to see tech in a silos right now. It's definitely a very political topic at the moment, but for reporters in Brussels, it's also a challenge on how to explain facts to people also outside Brussels about tech laws, how they work here, and how it's not seen as a weaponization against US big tech companies, as certain senators in the US have recently stated. And so that's also an interesting exercise. I think the US administration is definitely moving very quickly. That's not the case in the EU. I think the EU is trying to move in the same pace as it did before and not get influenced by the very dynamic nature of US politics at the moment. But yeah, it's going to be interesting few years ahead for us on tech.
So Anisha, turning to you, a lot of what we're talking about is already happened in India. A couple of examples Reena's pointed to, and you've covered those extensively, like why technology is a political story. And you've done a recent investigation on Modi's battle to control the democracy narratives. And quoting from that, I think is very fitting here, that a democracy that claims strength but cannot tolerate scrutiny. I think that's really a powerful quote that sums up what we're discussing today. So what are specific political tactics from Modi's playbook that resonate with current trends of US politics and elsewhere?
Thanks, Amsha. And yeah, of course, we see a lot of parallels between what happened in India and what's happening in the case of US right now with the second Trump administration. I think it's very important to note, like in the case of India, democratic erosion didn't happen overnight. It was a slow strategic process that began with controlling the flow of information, controlling media, and using federal agencies like the Modi government did. So very early on, the Modi government realized that it can use federal agencies to go after critics, to go after the media, to go after independent media, and also through corporate takeovers, for example, the case of NDTV, which was seen as one of the last remaining bastions of independent journalism in Indian television, TV news, sorry. And we see something similar happening with the kind of remarks that Jeff Bezos has made regarding the editorial in Washington Post, or the fact that the Trump administration wanted to control its White House press correspondence pool by sidelining AP and platforming more non-traditional pro-government voices, more right-wing outlets, podcasters, influencers, that sort of thing. And in India, we saw part of my investigation was an official policy document by the government that said we need to deploy cabinet ministers to see how we can control information, put more pro-government voices out there, have influencers interview the prime minister, stuff like that. And Mr. Trump has only been giving interviews to Fox News. He's gone after traditional media. He's been very critical of it. Even today, the news in Atlantic over the Signal Gate, and now that it's being called, Trump's first reaction was to criticize the Atlantic. In India, the government did go after media quite strategically. And what happened as a subsequent reaction was that more and more journalists looked towards independent media, digital outlets, websites, stuff like that. And as Reena mentioned, the government found a way of even going after digital platforms, targeting through legislations any content that it deemed critical against the nation's interest. So yeah, I do see some similar patterns emerging with what's happening in the US.
Thanks so much, Natalia. A couple of questions have come already. One was obviously an advice for young tech journalists entering the field at this time. Second is a question about journalists fighting disinformation. What are key tactics they could use for evading censorship?
Both are really big questions. I think completely relate to everything that everyone else is saying. And I think Reena was talking about everything right now in the US feeling incredibly familiar to those of us who have either grown up or worked in other authoritarian contexts. Very distinct feeling that we've seen the movie before, but I think it's also important to remember that we don't know how it ends. America is different and the dynamics are different. The caveat is, of course, the authoritarianism has spread very successfully in very different contexts. Having said all of it, and yes, it's unbelievable. I am in the US at the moment, and it's unbelievable that now flying into the country, I would have to do the same things I used to do flying into Iran or Uzbekistan or Burma, wipe the phone and take all those precautions. It's a bizarre world we suddenly live in. But I think it does make me perhaps naively optimistic about the need for journalism and for quality journalism. And again, in the first part of the session, many people talked about the growth of audience and people coming to smaller players, like I think most people in this call, like Wired excluded, but even Wired is not a huge publication compared to the old kind of old gatekeepers and old giants. I do think we live in the world where we increasingly, so I believe in the future of journalism. I think we increasingly need to ask ourselves what journalism is for and what purpose we're serving, because I think we have always equated abundance of information with understanding, and the information has in fact been turned into a tool of censorship, I believe. No, is the censorship. So I think for everyone in our industry or wanting to get into it, I think the question we should be asking ourselves is, what am I doing it for, and how can I contribute to the conversation in a how can I be useful rather than be adding to the noise? Because I think it's one of the greatest tools that authoritarians have at their disposal. They have weaponized information and media very successfully, almost against itself, just the way they weaponized elections. Isn't easy, but I think it's also a pretty, it's like the Chinese curse, where we live in interesting times.
Thanks so much. One question that I have, and maybe I can start with you, Reena, is what are the stories that you're paying attention to right now in the midst of all of this? And as we said, that this is not just a US story, but it's a global story. So what are some of the key narratives that you're paying attention to? And what are some early warning signs based on experience of covering similar tactics in other regions that would be useful to share with journalists in US as well?
We continue to pay close attention to the tech giants in the other countries. So trying to hold them accountable in the markets where they have reduced resources. They've cut back on their content moderation teams, for example. They've decimated trust and safety. And these are markets where people also don't have the option of turning to the government or to courts for protection. So trying to hold tech giants accountable in these countries. The other theme that we are looking at quite closely and are alert to is when the US withdraws in terms of funding of, say, nonprofit organizations or media organizations in the rest of the world, who is filling that space? Is it China? Is it Russia? Is it like who is filling these spaces, or do these spaces not go filled? China is, of course, a massive technology presence in many of these countries, be it through their apps, their social media apps, or their companies, or their electric vehicles. These are countries that have embraced Chinese technology because it's more accessible, it's cheaper. So we're definitely watching that very closely. And I would say holding technology companies accountable in countries that don't have as much of a rule of law, for example, and looking at China's increasing presence in these countries is something we're keeping a very close eye on. I'm not sure I can offer up words of advice because these are countries that don't really regard institutions with a lot of respect. If you look at press freedom, many of these countries, 26 of 32 Asia-Pacific countries last year slipped in the rankings on the press freedom index, but none of these countries care, right? So you can go on. The religious freedom index that is released by, I think it's Freedom House or another institution, India has like consistently slipped on that. And India is basically, we don't believe this index. When there are institutions trying to hold governments accountable, they just don't care about it. Journalists trying to hold their governments accountable, I'm heartened to see journalists still doing that, still trying to do that. But it is getting increasingly harder. In Cambodia, Mech Dara, a local journalist who has been reporting extensively on the cyber scam compounds and the involvement of the Cambodian government, was finally arrested last year. And then he was forced to read a public confession that everything he reported on was false under threat of harm to him and his family. And he's literally quit journalism because he does not see a future for himself in that country. We talk about journalism in an exile. I hope it doesn't come to that in the US, but a lot of journalists in countries like Myanmar, Iran, China, there are so many countries where journalists have been reduced to reporting from other countries because it's no longer safe for them or their families to be reporting in their own countries. There's this very popular video, he's an influencer on YouTube who reports, who produces these segments on India. And he does not live in India. Like most people don't even know where he lives because he's under enormous pressure from the government. I don't know, maybe journalism in exile is the only option for a lot of journalists going forward because they don't feel safe in their countries anymore. I wish I could say that I see more people supporting independent media, but this is not true of many developing countries where there is an enormous distrust of media, thanks partly to the government, blaming them for all sorts of things. Recently, Vietnam folded in the media industry under its Ministry for Sports, Culture, and Tourism, which tells you exactly what this government sees the media's function being as. It's to portray a positive image of the country. And there are a lot of people in the country that will agree that is what the media is meant to do. In many countries that will agree that's what the media is meant to do. So the small minority of people who continue to believe that the media has an important role in holding government and institutions accountable are often not in a position to support the media, to take a stance for the media. So it is unfortunate that A, there's diminishing resources for media institutions, and B, that resources from elsewhere are also reducing. So I guess my only takeaway from that would be that what we do is important in all of these countries, and particularly in countries where governments are cracking down on media and on people who question the government, and needs to go on. And I'm very encouraged to see people still doing the work that needs to be done. And at Rest of World, for example, we have a huge network of freelancers that we work with very closely. And that's a group of journalists who don't get talked about much very often. Yes, we have our reporters, but we rely very heavily on freelancers who are local to the country, who don't get as many opportunities to publish in their country's public, in their country's media, for example. And we give them the opportunity to work with us. And I would appeal to media organizations to work with freelancers, with local freelancers, wherever they can, because you're not only giving them the resources to continue to work with, but you're also giving them a bigger platform from where they can be heard. So that is something I would definitely ask people to keep in mind, US publications, to work with local freelancers more.
Absolutely great piece of advice. It's also, in a way, also more alarming, the changing situation in US and Western democracies, because like you said, this is where people turn to when they can't protect themselves in their home countries. So definitely this is also another layer that we're also continuing to track, the funding question, but also where do people go when their safe havens, so to say, are also facing the similar challenges. So Anupriya, one question for you I have is, of course, like you've already mentioned in your first remark, there are a lot of challenges with regulation, particularly with the DSA and accusations of censorship from Europe's side. What are some challenges that you face as a tech reporter when there's a lot of misinterpretation of European laws, not just internationally, but also within Europe? Are you also seeing the impact of this type of framing of European laws within Europe? Are there challenges within Brussels? Is the narrative shifting?
Yes, regarding the DSA and what it actually means for platforms can be misinterpreted both in the US and in the EU. And of course, the instinct as a reporter is to comment on probably every post on X by Elon Musk criticizing the DSA and using it more as a weapon to criticize a larger geopolitical issue. And it has been used increasingly by mostly the far right in Brussels and seeing more as a debate for and against free speech. And it's somehow become a tool for the far right to say that this is a legislation that is promoting censorship in Brussels and EU. And now they have received some sort of assistance from X and Elon Musk. For example, 2 months ago, Elon Musk used X to interview the far-right AfD candidate, Alice Weidel, just before the German elections took place in February. And part of the concern was, of course, that he is providing a very big platform to this candidate, but that would not be something that the DSA would legislate per se. It could be other pieces of laws. But the DSA, for example, would say if he is using the recommender systems or artificially boosting his posts in a way that's not compliant to the tech laws. But it was also seen by the far right and a few parties to sort of change the narrative that this law is used to censor certain political parties, certain political movements. But that's not the case. Of course, it's hard to be able to prove that's not the case rather than prove that it is the case. The DSA has become rather a political tool. For example, about 2 months ago or a month ago, U.S. Representative Jim Jordan sent a long letter to Commissioner Hanna Virkkunen, who's the tech commissioner here, and the competition commissioner, Teresa Ribera, talking about the DSA and also in extension the DMA, but on the DSA specifically, that it was censoring free speech and used as a tool by the EU to censor US-based tech companies, keeping in mind, of course, Elon Musk's criticism on this topic. And then politicians from the European Parliament visited Washington just after the letter was sent, so it was a good timing. And they told us that it also comes from a lack of understanding what the DSA is, but really seen as a tool by US politicians and EU politicians to then criticize Brussels, criticize tech legislation, and manipulate the notion of what free speech means also to their advantage.
Thank you. And with that, I think we're at time. What is time flies when we're having good conversations. So thank you so much to all of you for participating. This has been very insightful.
That's it for this episode. I hope you'll send your feedback. You could write to me at justin@techpolicy.press. Thanks to our guests. Thanks to my co-founder, Brian Jones. Thank you for listening.
Tech Policy Press.